He's been involved in organizing this conference. It's been an amazing conference. Having been to several Linux and other conferences recently, I can tell you it's really awesome to be at such a conference that's purely technical in nature. It's been a real refreshing change from the kind of conferences that I've been involved in recently. In particular, I'd also like to give particular thanks to some of the organizers of the conference, Paul Hutton, Andrew Hutton, Craig Ross. Amazing guys. The team that put together the proceedings, Brenda Butler, Greg Franks, David Huggins Danes. Great job, guys. Finally, the sponsors, Corel, Rebel, The Puffin Group, HP, Loki Entertainment, Zero Knowledge, Eurocom, and of course, Achilles. These are the guys who've put the most effort into this. Great job. Okay, so a lot of you guys are probably wondering, who is this guy and what did he do with Alan Cox? Even if I take out my beret there, I still don't quite have the look down. My name is Gavriel State. I work at Corel Corporation on our Linux applications development team. I used to actually be in charge of the team, but that didn't really leave enough time for coding, so had to stop. What I'm here for is to introduce Alan Cox, our keynote speaker this evening. However, I plan to do so in a bit of a roundabout way, so please bear with me. Alan has come to talk to us about software engineering practice in the open source environment. So I thought I'd begin with a brief discussion of a particular open source project that's near and dear to my heart, and that is the Wine Win32 on Linux project. Next slide, please. I didn't actually have time to prepare a full session, so this is going to be sort of an abbreviated version of this talk. It could go on for quite a lot longer. So why do I care about Wine? Well, we at Corel have several tens of millions of lines of pure Win32 code that we would really like to have running on Linux. Wine is the quickest route to getting those applications running on Linux. Now, whenever I talk to Linux developers who aren't familiar with Wine, I always hear the same misconceptions repeated over and over, and I'd really like to put these to rest. So, next slide, please. First of all, for those of you who don't know, what is Wine? Wine is Win32 on Linux and X. It allows you to take an existing Win32 binary in Microsoft's PE binary format and run it directly on an x86 Linux box. It's also a source-compatible environment. That means that you can take your source code, recompile it, and have a fully native application. So what are some of the myths? Next slide, please. Okay, first of all, myth number one, Wine isn't native. Well, what does native really mean anyway? No CPU emulation is involved at any point in Wine. All the code that runs on an x86, for example, is pure x86 code. There's no CPU emulation that you see in many other emulation type projects. Wine, in fact, stands for Wine is not an emulator. Now, the next point, what is native? Well, if you're running the code for your native CPU, what is the difference between something running from Wine versus something that's a Linux compiled executable? It's very simple. The execution format is different. In Wine, you have Windows PE binaries, whereas in Linux, you have ELF binaries. And you know what? From the end user point of view, who cares? Finally, Wine implements the Win32 APIs on top of POSIX and X. And you know, so does GTK and Qt. They implement their APIs on top of POSIX and X. So really, from that point of view, Wine becomes just another GUI library like GTK and Qt. Finally, in terms of actual UI look and feel, it is somewhat tunable, and we certainly have plans to improve that in the future. Next slide, please. Okay, here's another myth that people often think. You need to have Windows installed. Not at all true. The Wine loader can actually run Microsoft's native DLLs, but it's optional. You don't have to. And there have been replacements written, and work is continuing on those replacements for such important Windows DLLs as COM Control and COM Dialog. Next slide. Here's another myth. It's slow. Well, this one, unfortunately, is a little bit true at the moment. However, Wine is still in alpha release. Not a lot of work has gone into tuning and performance optimizations. Certainly, with our applications, we want them to run as fast as possible, and we're going to be spending a lot of time doing performance optimizations. Right now, most of the builds that people get off the net are, in fact, debug builds that have lots of debug messages in them, lots of asserts and lots of traces and so on. Turning those off and doing a proper optimized build helps by at least 30% or so. Finally, there are a large number of Windows APIs. In a given application, only 5% of those APIs are going to be the problem cases that you need to actually speed up. 95% of the time, it doesn't matter that you're using a Windows API like Create Window to put a window up on the screen versus a native API, because it doesn't matter whether it takes an extra tenth of a second to put a window up on the screen. However, if you're doing, for example, graphics-intensive code, such as bitmaps, then yes, that stuff does make a difference, and those are the areas that remain to be optimized. Next. Another myth, it's only useful in x86. Not at all true. The PE loader only runs on x86. Nobody has actually done the work required to get the PE loader to run alpha PE binaries and MIPS PE binaries, but not really a lot of people care that much about non-x86 Windows binaries. On other CPUs, Wine can serve as a source portability environment. And I didn't really want to bring my other laptop here, but my other laptop's a Mac PowerPC, and I have a kind of nice demo, which is a simple WineLib app that's built natively for PowerPC using GCC and linking to the Wine library as opposed to the using the loader. Finally, we're working very closely with Cygnus to improve the compiler support to add more Microsoftisms, such as anonymous unions, anonymous structures, and that sort of thing, as well as precompiled headers, which is a necessity if you're trying to port Windows applications. That work is coming, and much of that work will, in fact, be useful for other projects as well. That work is coming, and source compatibility is improving very quickly. Next. This is a funny one. Whenever something on Slashdot comes up about Wine, this one always somehow seems to show up. I don't really understand why. I think it's because there's a lot of sort of ex-OS2 users who are using Linux now who from the OS2 experience, there wasn't much reason not to use Win32 APIs on OS2, and that's why that's one reason why native applications were few and far between. However, the Linux world is already diverse enough to support KDE and GNOME and Motif and so on, so I don't really see any reason that Wine should be any different than that. Also, for new applications, there are much better cross-platform portability solutions available. If you wanted to write an app today that you hadn't started yet, I would choose Qt or there are several other fully cross-platform libraries that can be used to implement applications. And there'd be no reason for you to write directly to Win32. Next. Here's another big one. This one is often something that people have actually given one a try or have a misconceived notion of. Wine does work. In fact, it's running this presentation now, as you'll see in a moment or two. We're running the Corel Presentations Player application, and once we're done with the presentation, we'll flip back into X, and you will see that this is not a smoke and mirrors act. Now, the reason why a lot of people think that is because they try something and it doesn't work, and the problem is that Wine is still alpha, and changes that are made affect large numbers of applications. And so while your application may not work today, if you look back in the development archives, you often find that somebody has gotten it running 3 weeks ago, and a change that has been checked in the past 3 weeks has broken your application. If you focus on the APIs that a particular application uses, you can get extremely good results. So for us, we've been spending the last 8 months or so focusing on the APIs that our Office applications use, and as you can see, we're getting some pretty good results. Next. Okay. So that's sort of the background of myths about Wine. This is where I segue into Alan's presentation. Wine is a very interesting software engineering project. It's an attempt to duplicate a vast API which has been sort of growing spaghetti-like for several years, and to do so in an open source manner. Now, of course, everybody who's working on Wine has their own idea of the favorite app they want to run. So a lot of developers out there want Wine because they want to be able to run their Win32 games on Linux. And so there's a lot of Win32 games that now run reasonably well on Linux. Unreal, for example, I've heard has recently become pretty much 100% functional. Now, any given application only uses a finite range of those Win32 APIs. And so Wine can be useful without being complete, because it can implement, if you implement just the APIs your application needs, then for the purposes of that application, you're done. Now, at the same time, there's a lot of overlap between what two given applications need to use in the Win32 API, and that actually leads to a bit of a problem, at least the problem of fragility. If a number of applications need a certain API to work in a particular way, but one application needs it to work in a slightly different way, then when somebody puts in a fix that changes that API, it affects a lot of applications. So Wine is sort of simultaneously very parallelizable, because you can put developers on all these different applications that they're interested in, but also very fragile, which is a very important point about how it works with Alan's talk, I think. And that's pretty much it for the talk on Wine. So let's talk about Alan Cox. Those of you who don't know about Alan, he's been working on the Linux kernel for several years now, and has done more things than I can understand, let alone list. He's currently maintaining the 2.0 kernel tree, and is the most important developer, I think, on the 2.2 kernel. He basically does the job of integrating new patches that get sent in on the kernel development list. And so with that, I will segue over to Alan. And there we go. There you can see that not quite absolutely everything is done in Wine yet. But we are that was actually running in Wine. Yes. We'll fix those.
Right, technology on, right? Okay, this is where we do the high-speed laptop swap, which is it's the new improvement on the changing equipment between bands that used to go on gigs. We can do this one a bit quicker, I hope. Okay, so. The actual basis of this talk is something I've been looking at for a long time, about for 9 months, which is how actual software engineering theory as taught and software engineering practice as taught, which are two different things anyway, relate to free software, and also about how to make sure this sort of thing doesn't happen with free software too. That, by the way, that's Heathrow Airport. This was a lucky catch on the way to Canada. Okay, can we have the slides? Okay.
Wow.
Yes. Nice TrueType fonts. Yeah. Next page. Okay. First thing to talk about then is, what do we mean by software engineering in the conventional sense? It boils down to a set of things they spend about a year teaching you in computer science, which at the end of the year fit onto about two pieces of paper for revision notes. If you squash them really hard, they fit onto one slide. First one is that you form your programmers into teams. So you have junior programmers and you have senior programmers. The senior programmers like it, the junior programmers don't. And you can only have six people in a programming team, because if you have more than that, they spend so much time talking to each other and failing to tell each other important things that your entire project goes to pieces. So you split them into little groups. You have a hierarchical management structure. So every little group has a manager. And it turns out you can only put six managers in a group before they spend all of their time arguing and failing to get anything done. The only thing that appears to be exempt from this theory is salesmen. Oh dear. Can we? Okay. I guess the screensaver's still on. Yeah. Right. So we have a hierarchical tree-like management structure with layers of management on a big on a small project. You don't really have that many layers. On a big project, you're looking at a very, very large hierarchical management structure. Okay, other thing to say at this point, there are people who do non-free software different ways to this. This is looking at things in very general terms. There are also people who do free software projects in very non-free ways. Oh, I'm generalizing. You have a clear design order. You have a formal specification. Sometimes before that, you actually sit down. You figure out the needs of the project, the time it will be required to be available, when the hardware that goes with it is coming out. It's all very nicely planned. Of course, in the real world, the formal specification is frequently, oh my God, they've just shipped something, when can we have ours out? I'm sure people like Mike Shaver are familiar with some of these. Oh, sorry. Okay, and you have a design specification, at least in theory. As a good software project, you have a design specification. In a bad software project, you kind of make it up and hope nobody notices. And the most important thing looking at it, you have a very detailed analysis of the interface between modules. Because you have your hierarchical structure and your teams of programmers, if you don't have a clear understanding of how the code they write fits together, the code they write will not fit together. Even with good interface definitions, a lot of the work in a large software project actually turns out to be reconciling interesting interpretations of the documentation. It's not just unique software. Anyone who's ever tried to write a device driver will be familiar with the number of different ways you can interpret a document. And then there's marketing. And you normally do your marketing after you've got most of the code written, and sort of 6 weeks before you start the hype. If it's Java, you start 2 years before and you pretend you've got a product. But in the general case, you start a few weeks before, you start putting adverts in the press. And this is going on at the same time as you're finalizing the code, putting the last bits of the code together. And in theory, your marketing and your code coincide beautifully. The marketing splash hits and you ship the code. Frequently, the marketing splash hits, and then you post lots of explanatory notes, and then eventually you ship the code. That is how what we call the software engineering model tends to work. Now, can we have the next slide? The free software model. We still have programming teams. In fact, we still have very small programming teams, and you'll find, if you actually look hard, most of the teams of people working on any given project, there are six or less people. And I don't think that is a coincidence. There's a hierarchy, and then there are certain organizations, such as the NetBSD project, the FreeBSD project, Apache, where there is a very formal, very definite core team. There are other projects like the Linux project, where there is most definitely not a core team, honest. And I think everybody in this room can name them. So you can however you look at it, there is always a hierarchy. There are always sort of core people. And you get this kind of hierarchy of development of software. So like a 68,000 patch for Macintosh will go to the Macintosh maintainer, to the 68,000 maintainer, and then possibly eventually up to Linux to be merged into the main tree. And these hierarchies are definitely there. So that is actually in some ways very similar to the conventional model. We're using similar sized teams of people. We're working with a hierarchy even if we try very hard to deny it. Access points between teams is a bit different. In a lot of commercial software environments, access to discussion between teams goes on not between team members of different teams, but through the management structure. In the free software thing, what is much more common is that random people from different teams will start discussing particular interfaces that they care about. That's something I'll come back to a little bit more later on. We have a different design order. You write the code, kind of. You make it sort of work, and you just about well enough that you can put it on fresh meat and say, hey, look, I've got this really cool project. That's the marketing. Because you need programmers for your project, you do your marketing before you write the real version of the code, or rather before they write the real version of the code. At some point after this, you get reasonable working code. And then if you're a really disciplined free software programmer, you write the documentation. In actual practice, a lot of the documentation comes from third parties. There are exceptions. There are even people like Cygnus who actually won't take your patch unless you send them a changelog entry. And this causes real friction and argument about some of the changes. Okay, next slide. Communication, right. A conventional software engineering project is mostly a tree-based hierarchy. There are some clues going on here in that related parts of the project will be under the same layers of management. But to get between any given people when you wish to talk to them, you often post to give a proposal to a manager who gives it to another manager who doesn't understand what you're talking about, who hands it down to the person he thinks is responsible but he's not quite sure, who hands it to a programmer in the hope that they understand it because this is like 15 years since he last wrote any code. Funnily enough, information gets lost quite badly from my experience in one of the large companies I worked for. So, and talking directly to other teams is not done. I mean, frequently they work for different parts of the company and you don't talk to them. They're your rivals. You know, forget this competition with the other company. You know, it's the other half of your company. They're the real rivals. And so you get this kind of Chinese whispers problem where half of the information passed around your project only gets there because somebody emails someone who shouldn't know or happens to know the right person. Or occasionally some of it gets through the management chain. They do try very hard to avoid that. Free software model is a little different again. That's what I decided to call the information hose pipe. Instead of information being filtered aggressively for you, everything you could possibly want to know about the project, discussions about what editor you should be using to work on the project, possibly two or three guys who like nothing to do but tell you why you're doing your project wrong because he's read a book on it. all these kind of things, and you get what I should describe as the information hose pipe. All the information you could possibly want is available. The only problem is, if you try to read it all, you won't get any work done. Most of them have a charismatic project leader. You've got somebody like Miguel or Linus. So Peter Salas said at Atlanta last year, which is one thing to think about this bit, almost every major free software package, you can name the package and you can name at least one person who is significant to it. So SendMail, Eric Allman, Samba, Andy Trigel, Miguel de Casa, and so on. So there tend to be these bunch of people who stand out in the community, sometimes by being odd, by being weird, or sometimes by being right. There are also some projects where it's not even about necessarily being possibly charismatic, but right is actually more important. Qmail, for example, Dan Bernstein. Dan Bernstein is probably not most people's idea of your diplomatic, organized leader. But Dan Bernstein's Qmail project works because Dan is almost invariably right, which actually infuriates people even more. it's all very well having someone who's to a certain extent arrogant, but someone who's arrogant and right is the most infuriating person you will meet. Direct communication. There is no requirement that you go through people. If you tell Miguel to please tell a member of another part of the GNOME project to adjust this interface, the reply you get is probably not going to be printable, is it? The replies you will actually almost always get is, it's just a response like, I need to know about this, is talk to so-and-so. So the free software projects are building up communication lines. They change as needed. And they fall into place. If two people's projects start to collide, then you get a communication point directly between those two pieces of the project. And your project interfaces start to mirror your software interfaces. It doesn't always work. And sometimes you do get two people writing basically the same code. CD players are good for this. Anyone counted the number of GNOME CD players recently? But it does, to an extent it works, and there are one of the things project leaders tend to end up doing is spending a lot of time grabbing hold of groups of people and pointing them at each other and saying, look, you're overlapping, maybe you can help each other. So is this idea of connecting people rather than passing messages. This is good, because when you connect two people to each other, they're probably only half as likely to forget to say something as passing it through a third party who is going to be away, busy, hit D on your mail because he was bored. down the pub, all the things that people normally do. Information going through people is regularly lost. Ian Jackson tried to measure this in the Debian project, and he reckoned it's about 50-50 whether a piece of information gets through a third party or not. Okay, next slide. Code structure. Now, this is different to the management structure of your project. And this is another thing I started looking at. Successful free software is either very small or very modular. And the modularity is vastly more modular than most conventional software projects, at least for free software that survives. There is another species of free software which turned into a really, really nasty puddle everyone tries to pretend didn't happen. So the other thing, interfaces favor isolation over speed. That actually came as a bit of a surprise to me, because Linux kernel, Samba, Apache, to a great extent, they're known for being fast, at least when Minecraft aren't measuring them anyway. given real-world situations, they tend to be fast. And what tends to happen if you look at the Linux kernel is that the standard interfaces are very simple, then very clean, they're not necessarily very fast. But there are other interfaces that you can get involved in by talking directly between two or three groups of people, which are faster. But you have to make the choice, and you have to effectively join in and become part of the involvement with those interfaces. If you don't want to be involved in fancy, sophisticated interfaces and basically pulling clever tricks, you can write your code, and you can reasonably expect it will continue to work for long periods of time. So effectively, you can opt to be, rather than being the fastest possible, you can opt to be a nice, safe, reasonably sane driver. It's really, for kernels, a good example of drivers. There are actually very few interfaces within the program where speed is important. Most of the interfaces between two pieces of software are actually rarely called. So it's only the small number that matter. And for those small number, you can talk to the person who was involved in inventing the interface directly. Interfaces are group maintained. In a lot of conventional software projects, an interface was designed in the interface specification document. Notice before it was written, which is actually possibly a mistake in the first place. The definition is frequently the holy doctrine not to be questioned. Where it can be questioned, it's almost always the responsibility of the people who maintain that specific code. In a lot of free software things, this is not the case. People who are using an interface also modify, improve, and update the interface. So the owner of, for example, a generic SCSI layer gets patches from driver writers saying, it would be really neat if the SCSI layer did this, or bycard needs it to do that. And effectively, they are changing the interface contract. And they're doing it in ways which most people work on large software projects in the conventional sense would actually be absolutely horrified by. Because your whole project is continuously crawling and shuffling its parts around, and changing the rules just slowly and gently. So you don't have your nice, clear, solid structure. It's basically evolving. And there's direct communications between people, as I said, when using an interface. If you're going to change an interface, you talk directly to the people involved in the interface. You don't schedule meetings. You don't put a proposal through various layers of managers. The email goes directly from one person to the other, frequently with a patch file attached, and then frequently comes back with a why you are completely crazy attached to the other end. But then this then eventually settles down and an answer is found. Okay, next slide. So I think another idea to think about, this is one I've not really explored much yet, is that free software projects evolve. Many of them are not designed as such. They just kind of grow. Certainly, 5 years ago, Linux was not designed and carefully planned out to run on IBM 390s, Palm Pilots, 8 processor Xeons, and all the other things it runs on. In fact, if someone had sat down to do that, they would have said, we can't do this. So they evolve. A lot of the interfaces which you get in a software project, even when you try, even when you're talking to other people, turn out to be particularly stupid ideas. It doesn't matter, because a stupid idea in version 1 of the program becomes an unused piece of software in version 2 of the program. The only thing which actually matters is that everybody who's using an interface doesn't mind it being removed. or in some cases that the interface is so bad we've removed it anyway and enough people will be horrified that they will fix the rest of the code. And a lot of major kernel changes happen this way. Linus basically says, this sucks, I've made the following change, all of your file systems are broken. And with the sure knowledge that eventually somebody will fix them because somebody will want to read an MS-DOS disk one day. Occasionally you have to do that. And it creates ripples through a whole project. So these things are very rare. When they happen, there's normally been a big build-up of pressure over it over time. There's this colossal bang as all the changes sort of take place. Complex interfaces aren't used. As far as I can tell, the biggest reason for this is because the programmer cannot be bothered to read the instruction manual. If it takes you longer to read the instructions for how to call an interface than to write your own quick, simple, dirty, probably only works most of the time kind of interface, the programmer will write their own. So interfaces have to be simple because programmers don't read documentation. Another thing we have, interfaces between modules are very much minimized. There are lots of cases in projects where small amounts of code are duplicated because although you could use a piece of code from an apparently unrelated module, you have no idea if the other people will eventually change their copy. So we duplicate code at times rather than actually do sort of proper software reuse. Because what should happen is someone will say, this software is clearly the same. We'll start another team of programmers. We'll make a generic version of this particular software. And what tends to happen quite often, we get several specialized ones. Another one is modules tend to talk to core modules much more than each other. So you get a small set of interfaces everybody uses. Not just the low-level interfaces, you'd expect like library interfaces, but at the higher level. Within the kernel, all the device drivers talk to a very small number of interface points. Within the GIMP, if you look at the GIMP plugin interface, the number of functions available to a GIMP plugin are very small. And every GIMP plugin tends to call those functions that the GIMP plugins don't indiscriminately call between each other. There is a clear hierarchy of call structure within most free software programs. Okay, next. Interface reuse. Now, the correct and traditional religion on interface reuse and the free software one are very different. In a traditional environment, if you notice something is clearly a reusable software component and you get out your textbook, you look at the perfect algorithm for the generic case for this particular problem, and you write a solution which has a function which does everything you could possibly conceive somebody will ever need to do with this object. In the free software world, that very rarely happens. What you do is you say, well, that code's kind of like what I need. I'll borrow it. I'll add my fixes to it. I might mail it back to the original author if I'm good and I remember. And so you get this approach where rather than actually sitting down and saying, clearly the right way to build, say, this linked list object is to sit down and plan it out and implement every function. Someone basically comes along and implements most of a linked list, and someone comes along and implements the interrupt safe version of it. Then somebody else will say, well, it's almost right, but I need to be able to do these two or three extra fancy functions, so I'll stick those into my project. And you evolve an object which is very flexible. It doesn't do everything. It just happens to do everything that anybody actually needs. We have a limited. You also get a limited number of actual interface points and interfaces themselves. Look at the Linux kernel. Every character device driver uses the same interface. So there are a very small number of interface definitions used by a very large number of modules. Again, GIMP plugins, same kind of thing. The flexibility thing comes in. A lot of the interfaces are designed to be used in as many different ways as possible. Rather than design an interface for a particular problem, you design an interface where you give, for example, the entire data to some arbitrary piece of code and say, look, fix it, play with it, and give it me back. And you don't care what the other piece of code does to the data. So you give a piece of data and a length, he gives you the result and a length. The extreme case of this in the Unix tradition is the vast number of applications which allow you to feed something through an arbitrary shell script, which is called by the program. And the shell script is basically a very clear, very simple interface for giving someone all of the data, saying, look, I don't care, just go away and do whatever stupid, weird thing I haven't thought about that you want to do. And it's also part of the sort of software tools idea of Unix. And you see the number of mailers, for example, you see where you can feed your mail message through Perl or through a similar tool. A number of web servers where you can where you've got static content. You've got various form handling interfaces and stuff. And then everything else, you kind of mock up together in Perl with the CGI interface. CGI is the absolute beautiful example of this. I have no idea what you're doing, but here is every piece of data you could possibly want. Here is the file handle to write the output on. I am just going to get completely out of your way. So you look for flexible interfaces. Okay, next. Right. Free software is generally late. Conventional software, you plan ahead. So in 6 months' time, you realize your customer is going to have a need for the following feature. Or more exactly, in 6 months' time, your competitor is going to be offering the following feature. So long as you ship yours in about the same time period, everything's fine. In free software, it's generally a response to an event. So free software is late from the moment it's created. Like, for example, some of the photo applications. Someone gets a digital camera. I want to be able to use this on Linux. I ought to write some software. They've already got the camera, so the project is already late. If they had the software, they could use it. So we're working slightly different. The classic example I chose for looking at this is GNOME, because some people may argue with the original definition of late, but GNOME was clearly late in the commercial sense, because GNOME was created at the point where the competition was shipping something which is, well, it looked good, it gave the right impression, as long as you didn't click on too many buttons, it was pretty reasonable. So the KDE project was definitely the rival project, and it was definitely well ahead. So GNOME was definitely late from the start, no arguing about that. I thought you were going to call need-driven software. People don't write things in the free software environment because they happen to think, in a year's time, I might actually need an application that does this. They write a piece of software because they happen to already need it. The only time that free software is written ahead of needing it is when somebody is also paying the person concerned, which when it's not quite entirely free software. So, yeah, very pretty. Can we have the original one back? Okay, and the next slide. Okay, adding programmers to free software. This is where we get started to get interesting, because the basic idea of Brooke's Law, for people who don't know it, is that adding programmers to a late software project makes it later. Fred Brooks, JR, who established this, did it the really painful way of actually going through the experience at IBM with OS 360, and afterwards becoming an academic. It was kind of a self-defense mechanism. And every single commercial world case I've looked at, Brooke's Law is basically true. In the very long term, it makes your project faster. But in the short and medium term, things really suffer. Well, GNOME was late. The GNOME project added 200 people to a late project, and it sped up. That's not supposed to happen. What seems to happen is when you add programmers to a free software project, the size of the various teams who are working on bits of the project stay about the same size. Still, this magic number of six or less. What you get is that the extra programmers, first of all, they start on extra projects, so they will write more CD players for you. The other thing that they do, especially when prompted, is something which had previously been a single piece of code will split along a convenient interface point and become several projects. So each of these projects is now late, but each of these projects is now new. They're not adding programmers to an existing piece of code. You've just found an interface, sort of split it a bit, and you've now got two projects where you had one. You still have less than six programmers per project, and you still have this kind of hosepipe information mentality. You add 200 programmers, your mailing list gets 500 times as busy. But all the information is there if you can actually be bothered to dig it out. And the design and interface rules change. This is a big no-no in conventional software engineering. You do not go back and redesign chunks of your design document unless very bad things are happening to your project. In the free software case, we are continuously changing the interface rules, the design, the number of modules, and where the modules actually are, where they split within the project. I said they generally split along existing interfaces, which is to say that although something may be one person's project, it does tend to fit into chunks, and it'll split along the existing chunks. There are almost no cases I could find where people joined a project and actually sat down and discussed, how should we divide this project up? In almost every case, there was some kind of understanding, because it would start with two or three members saying, I want to join in this project. And some of them probably, well, how about you work on that bit? It's kind of a bit behind, haven't had time to look at it. And it seems that people pretty much instinctively are picking up the right places to break the project apart. And you get very clean interfaces then between the actual pieces of code involved. Next. The downside. Well, you don't get everything for free, unfortunately. The things you find is there's a lot less communications going on in a free software project. You might not believe it if you actually read the mailing list, but most of the people who do the real work don't read most of the mailing list. Things you get are, firstly, code duplication, because people take existing code and modify it to solve a new problem. Often the modified version isn't best expressed by merging it with the original. So you get two separate pieces of code, then three, then four. If you look at the Linux serial drivers, there are about 10 Linux serial drivers of the same origin, which all split off from the same original code base. It makes no sense to stick them back together, but at the same time, it means we've got more code to maintain than in the perfect case. We also duplicate bugs, because someone copies the original serial driver and they write the Cyclades driver. The original serial driver had a bug which leaked 4K of memory. Surprisingly enough, about 6 months after the original serial driver was fixed, someone noticed the Cyclades driver leaked 4K of memory. And the lack of communication often means that the fixes aren't propagated through every driver. And as things become more and more split off, and people often remember people don't borrow an entire driver, they'll say, ah, that's how you do mmap, copy. Or, that's an interesting way of doing the read function. I can use some of that. You get very small pieces of code where it's actually very hard to even realize that they come from the same origin. And this is something perhaps where better version control for free software is needed. So you can actually say, I stole this code from here, and you can look through your version control system, and you can basically, you need to be able to see cutting and pasting of blocks of code in version control, which is an interesting hard problem, which I'm sure is about an afternoon's Emacs Lisp for somebody. Let's go to the other thing. If you're going to write the definitive reference driver for something, please don't put any bugs in it. Because you will have 20 or 30 drivers all containing the same bug very rapidly. And some of the network driver bugs, we definitely got into the 20 or 30 range. And then someone has to sit down and fix them all. Next. So I was trying to look at, is the free software model a new model, an old model, or in any way a different model? Team sizes are very similar. You have six or less people working on any given chunk of code. That is, anything without clear external interfaces. We've got clear leaders. We don't call them managers. We don't draw Dilbert cartoons about them. We normally flame them on mailing lists instead, but... There's clear definition of leadership, and the leadership is merit-driven, which in theory is how leadership works in a commercial environment, because you promote the bright people. There's a thing called Paul's Law, which applies here, which says that everyone is promoted to the point of their own incompetence. Because if you're in a job you're good at, you're promoted. Eventually they find a job you're not good at, therefore they stop promoting you. We also have specialists and support staff, just like any company. Within the GNOME project, I was looking at this, there are people who do nothing but mailing lists. There are people who do nothing but fiddle with CVS, which is actually a whole lifetime's work. And there are people who have nothing better to do in life than fix all your autoconf files while sending you sarcastic messages explaining that you really ought to read info autoconf. And so there's this continuous hoovering going on in the background in this project. There are also people who keep the websites up to date, some of whom are people who just do websites. And so these are very much your support staff. And they're just like in a commercial organization. They're doing lots and lots of the grunt work, and everybody forgets they exist. Okay, next. Okay, free software, it's aggressively modular. There are lots of cases where free software is modular beyond the point where it is most efficient to be modular, but it's modular simply to keep communications between sections of a project down. The interfaces are very flexible, they're very simple. As interfaces in a lot of non-free projects tend to be quite complex, very well documented. Free software interfaces are very rarely documented. The best documentation you get is normally an email address and ask him. Complexity is bad. Any kind of complex interface tends not to get used, or if it gets used, it will get used wrongly. You can attach a 20-page manual to it. It will still be used wrongly because the manual is far too long to read. And the one thing, above all, you do not see in free software, at least not for very long, are subtle and interesting side effects to an interface. Because if no one's going to read the documentation, they are definitely not going to read the thing which says, important, read this before using interface. And the growth model is very much by fissioning intersections and by changing the interface specification. It's also much more gradual. There's no single body sitting down going, well, for version 1.0, we'll ship the following feature set. For version 1.2, we're going to ship this in 18 months' time. The following features will need 135 programmers. That'll cost so much. This particular kind of going on doesn't occur. There is some of it, because there are people actually sort of putting milestones in place and saying, well, that would be neat, but we're not going to really have it finished by December, so we'll just have to wait. So the interface change and the code change is much more gradual. The program gradually grows, develops a life of its own, and wanders off in interesting directions because there are crazy people working on particular areas of it. Okay, next. So, these are some of the conclusions. We have some differences. Free software projects generally have a very, very different communication model because you are allowed to talk to the guy who knows what he's doing. And there are basically the people in the way want to get out of the way as fast as possible because they've got the rest of the mailing list to read. All information is freely available. This is both a good and a bad point. Because it may all be there, but it's up to you to dig the information out. Instead of someone filtering information from you and protecting you, as it were, everything you could possibly never want to know about the project is simply blasted at your mailbox at high speed. It's up to you to filter it, pick out things you care about, and often people are not on the major mailing list. This is called, forget it, gnome list, no way. I'll just talk to two or three people who are dealing with the code I'm actually working on. It's much, much simpler. The management structure is a graph. There's no nice tree. And not only is it a graph, but it's continuously changing the points where it meets. When two modules, two programs, or two pieces of program happen to need to interrelate, then they tend to communicate for a while. Eventually, they will stop communicating, hopefully after solving the problem rather than after a flame war. And project leaders generally act linking people together, much more than coordinating the project. There's a lot less control from the top. It's really, really hard to steer a free software project. It goes off in whichever directions it wants. And all you can really do is make it get wherever it's going faster. Next. The code is aggressively modular. It's very, very split up. The interfaces are very, very simple. All code is reusable because it's free software. So you can't actually say, well, I'll write this piece of code nicely because it's going to be a reusable software component. Because you have no idea what particular horror you perpetrated somebody else is going to borrow without realizing they shouldn't have. Users of an interface are often the people who change it. And the last thing is, ugly code is only okay if it's localized. It doesn't really matter how a function works, so long as you can clearly see how you call it and you know what it does. Ugly code is bad anyway, but as long as it's localized, people in free software are much less fussy about it than in many other organizations. We have a lot in common as well, which I should have put on a slide but didn't get around to it. something about 2 a.m. last night in the pub, I think. Things we have in common. The actual project teams in a free software project are a similar size. Although we don't have a hierarchy for communication, we have very much a hierarchy of a management structure. We spend a lot of our time denying it exists, but it's definitely there. And those, I think, are the two which stand out as being similarities. The communication side, and in many ways the code structure, are very different. They're very less formally structured. And the number of interface points between them is very much smaller than an equivalent commercial project. And the final thing I came to the conclusion, free software is about avoiding knowledge. A lot of the way the software works, a lot of the way the communication works, is really about avoiding having to know everything that is going on. And so people are continuously trying to opt out of as many mailing lists, as many documents, and anything else they can avoid reading so they can actually get some work done. And I think that's perhaps where a lot of the communication model comes from, because with the communication model, you've got this idea, instead of people passing information, all they really want to do is say, look, talk to him, go away, leave me alone. I don't want to know you. I've got other things to do. I've got 800 emails left to read, and 600 of them saying, how do I do such and such? Who do I talk to about something else? So there's a real desire to push communications directly between people and to actually reduce the amount of communications, the amount of knowledge. Certainly within the kernel, this is true. You can write a Linux device driver with knowing nothing of large parts of the code. The modularity thing is also very much true. I regularly merge 2 megabytes of patches into a Linux kernel. It is probably under 1% of that code which clashes. Often none of it clashes. So all of these updates are hitting specific pieces of code, and there is almost never a clash between 2 actual updates in them, which gives you an idea of how modular things like the kernel have become. And they've evolved that way because they are free software projects. Right, so that is the theory. And that is also the last slide. So you can hit Q and we can all look at that rather amusing Heathrow departure again. That's better. Okay, now the next bit is questions, and then I believe it's down somewhere for fairly free beer and food, isn't it? Is it rebel.com sponsoring in the next chunk? Yes. Okay, anyway, questions first, assuming you aren't all urged to dash off the pub right now. Questions?
You will make the picture available.
Right? I'll make the picture available, yes. perhaps if I give Justin a copy to put on Slashdot. Can we arrange that? Any more? Yeah.
No, I think we ought to put the announcement on Slashdot, put the picture on your site so we can all Slashdot.
That's fine. My web server's on a 100 megabit link at Telehouse.
Did Mr. Torvalds want to be here today?
I don't even know if he was invited. I assume he was invited. Linus actually doesn't travel a lot now. I think we're having small children and other things like that. And also because if you do a large amount of traveling, it does actually get wearing in the end. Any more? Yes?
Have you ever considered using a spell check on your slides?
I did. I typed ispell, hit return, it said command not found, and I remembered something else I'd deleted off my palm top disk. I said, programmers don't write documentation. You shouldn't have been reading them, you're a programmer.
Uh-huh.
Yeah? People who get involved in major free software projects and attempt to leave them do get email for a very long time afterwards. That definitely happens. And there are often people who drift out of a project. So some of the people who drift out of the X project and come back a very large number of years later. They're very valuable people to have around. Because, as I said, a lot of the stuff is never quite written down. A lot of ideas never quite make it to paper. And if they made it all made it to paper, then, as I said, nobody would read it because it would be too much to read. With the X projects, Jim Gettys getting involved, at least on the fringes of X3, has made a real difference because he's, with things like the voice stuff, it's like, oh yeah, we kind of played with voice in X3, in X11, like 15 years ago or something. And so here's how we did it. Maybe you can use this interface. So all that kind of knowledge is really valuable.
Just wondering, I'm here for Computing Canada magazine. What I was wondering is this. There's all these Windows users who are very passive users, hoping Linux is going to save them. But in following the conference, Linux is a very active language because people who use it also want to play with it and interact. So are the Windows users kind of off in the dark there because they don't want a product that they can interact with?
I don't think so. One of the things distributors do is to basically give you very much slowed down snapshots of the goings on. So there's all these ideas exploding in people like Miguel's head. But by the time they come out on CD, they've been filtered a little bit and evolved. And they're also distributors very much aware of what you're saying. There's the lovely example of this a long time ago was somebody just talking to a SCO guy at a conference said SCO Unix was the most boring product he'd ever seen. And the SCO marketing guy stood up and said, thank you. Because that is exactly what their customer base wanted to hear, and he knew that. And the Linux vendors understand that you don't want a new CD every 4 weeks. You see things like Red Hat is out every 6 months or so. And you'll probably see some of the more, people aiming much more at the real corporate high-end market will be looking at even slower release schedules than this. Because a lot of these guys don't want change. It's all very having all this exciting stuff going on, but they prefer it went on somewhere else. They just want the benefits, they want the results. They don't want all of the chaos and the craziness. And your CD vendor and distributor, effectively, it's a way of filtering you. You're buying into a controlled product. You're buying a brand name which is certifying that all the bits you get all work together. They're all coordinated. They hopefully work all really well with all the software you've already got, the backward compatible, and all the nice things you want. And at the same time, if you are into technical and wondrous things, you can go off and you can go and join the mayhem, but you do not have to go and join the mayhem.
But do you think it will be the day that the Windows people will be able to get a Linux sufficiently that they can do what Windows is supposed to do, which is put in the computer and it will work?
Yes.
Without them knowing.
Yes.
Yeah, that's today.
With things like the GNOME and KDE desktop, it's pretty much here. The killer one is installing software. But the thing people forget is installing Linux is no harder than installing Windows. It's just that you don't have to install Windows because it already came on your machine. Mm-hmm. And so getting more and more vendors who will say things like, which operating systems do you want? Tick the box on the web form, hit OK, your PC turns up, is really, really important to that. So that you don't have to fight installing software. It just works. Yeah.
That? Anybody in projects, free software projects, and so what to do with people, and they realize these people really don't know anything yet, but they're desperate to learn.
It happens in free software in exactly the same way. You get people who turn up who say, I want to work on something. I have no idea what I want to work on. I've read the device driver's book. I've got this piece of hardware. What the hell do I do now? And some of that you can help a little bit by pointing people at projects where, especially initially, they can work on their own. Which in the free software thing tends to work very well because a lot of people they're very worried, you know, if they say, I'm going to work on this driver, then for the next 6 months, people are going to be emailing them and saying, how are you doing with your driver? And they've got this pile of code that won't work, and they're feeling really, really embarrassed about it. Whereas if they're working on some obscure piece of hardware they've got, if they fail and no one knows about it, and they've learned something in the process and they can try something different. But it's very much a real problem in both. The other problem we see is really funny, which is people who are really good programmers who absolutely passionately believe they're not capable of writing really good software. And we feel like all you have to do is just keep going convincing them. A good example of that is a guy called Pedro Roque. He used to sit on LinuxNet IRC and be interested in networking. Very, very smart guy who sit there going, well, I'd love to do something, but I can't really do this. We eventually got him to get a little bit involved in networking. He wrote about the first half of the Linux IPv6 stack, was working in Portugal. He now works in Silicon Valley in California for Cisco. Yes. So that's the other thing, and one of the other things you see with it.
Alan, we are cutting into beer time. Maybe one more question?
Well, we'll take one more question, then if anyone really wants to ask a question, they can lose beer time. But everybody else can run for the doors and get first to the bar.
And we can ask Alan all the questions over a beer that we want.
Now, that's an even better idea. Back there. I'm not convinced.
Beer.
Amongst other things, we haven't started any wars and we haven't killed anybody yet. I know the KDE known people are working on it, but...
Well, I get the thank you.
Okay.
Hang on a second.
Time you're cutting into.
Thank you, everybody. My name is Michael Mansfield, and I'm president of Rebel.com, and it's my pleasure to thank Alan for his presentation today. I trust everybody will keep the momentum of Linux alive and the communication as well, and I trust everybody's had a very good time. Alan, on behalf of everybody, thank you very much for your presentation. I only have a few words before we head out to a little bit of a party, and we actually have a small video for you that I wanted to play for you. It's our company video. If we can play it, let's go.
Came dancing to my door. Last night a little angel came pumping on the floor. You could ask yourself a question. Do I feel lucky? Or do you, punk?
Pray help from above. Behold, in the midnight hour, she cried more and more.
Snap out of it!
She don't like sleeping, she won't sit out there. Room well tired and lonely, she's near to bed. What set you free and brought you to me?
Come on, Johnny. Let's go someplace. Let's get out of here.
I'd like an omelet, please.
plain and a chicken salad sandwich on wheat toast. No mayonnaise, no butter, no lettuce. And now all you have to do is hold the chicken, bring me the toast, give me a check for the chicken salad sandwich, and you haven't broken any rules.
You want me to hold the chicken, huh?
I want you to hold it between your knees.
No shirt, no shoes, no dinosaur.
All right. Learn it. Know it. Live it.
Here's Johnny!
Ow!
Christ, Jake, take it easy.
Man. How much?
Ow!
Yeah. Ow!
Jesus!
Oh, shit!
Ah. Shit. Ah. Jesus Christ!
Hey. Yeah. Ow, you fat pig!
Over yet.
It is for me, sister. Look, I ain't in this for your revolution, and I'm not in it for you, princess. I expect to be well paid. I'm in it for the money.
Well, before we head out, I just wanted to thank everybody for coming, and more importantly, welcome to the Valley. The Ottawa Valley here is where I'm born and raised, and I think highly of it. Some of us call it Silicon Valley North, and I thank you all for attending. I'm very proud of this town, and I trust your visit has been enjoyable. Rebel.com is very happy to have been a co-host of the first Ottawa Linux Symposium. It's nice to see the momentum of Linux growing so fast. When Andrew and I first met to discuss this thing, I thought he was crazy. As we discussed the details, I realized he was crazy. But he pulled it off. Well done, Andrew. You know, further, I must agree that the gods are in our favor. Since this conference, we've had more rain in the few days than our region has seen in months. So on behalf of all the local farmers, thank you all. Actually, I do apologize for the heat for those penguins who prefer it cool. You see, in Ottawa, February is only 6 months away. The weather will be 60 degrees Celsius cooler. Maybe we should meet again at that time. While I'm on the weather, the Canadian Minister of the Environment called today concerned that this symposium was contributing to global warming. Further study, however, revealed that the heat is localized in Redmond. The place seems to be fuming, you know? You know, a little history was repeated today in Rome, New York, at the Woodstock concert. That was quite an era at that time. There was a whole bunch of nonconformists, and I see we have the same thing happening today. Today, you people are making history, and you should be proud of it. You know, a year ago, how many of us would have imagined we would be participating in a world-class event discussing Linux, technically? Just look around the room. This event has brought together a phenomenal number of world-class leaders in the development of Linux. As a result of the hard work and dedication of each and every one of you, Linux has been embraced around the world. You know, many of the reports regarding Linux being a threat to Microsoft are just beginning, you know. But I, for one, thank you for this alternative. As a rebel, I prefer choice. I prefer freedom. I will not conform needlessly. You know, as a matter of fact, I heard recently that Microsoft was so envious of the Penguin logo, they struck a committee to come up with a logo of themselves. I hear to date that the sheep has won out. You know, the first Ottawa Linux Symposium has been a huge success. Expected registration numbers were surpassed, and what a great couple of days it has been. Again, thank you to Andrew and to Craig. Yada, yada, presentations, informative discussions, lively, all of that good stuff. But really and truthfully, there is a great sense of pride here. Everyone has had their share in being part of what I consider the largest revolution in the computer industry since the inception of the PC. Be proud of yourselves and do not underestimate your contributions and your efforts. I also stand before you with enormous sense of pride and thank you for attending this successful event. I'm a firm believer of the possibilities surrounding Linux, and I'm very proud to have been able to be part of bringing this event to my own backyard. As a final note, I would like to invite you to join myself and the rest of the Rebel.com gang at a party we are hosting at the Hard Rock Cafe in the Byward Market. We will also be launching a CD of a Rebel.com band of Bingy Barker. He's an old Rasta Rebel, and I hope you enjoy him. Looking at Alan, I thought Jethro Tull might have been a better venue, but sorry, man, you know, it's just the way it is here. The Rebel.com has been very generous enough to dig deep and find some money for drinks between 7 and 9 o'clock. We were trying to estimate the number of drinks you guys would go through. The restaurant people thought maybe a beer an hour, you know, and I said, really, you know, so that's why we want to keep you going. At 7 o'clock, the cash register starts, you can have what you want, and at 9 o'clock, I got to pull it off, because with our reggae group and with you group, that's about 600 people at a $5 a drink, so it's $3,000 around, you know, so if you stick to one drink an hour, I'm cool, but we've estimated, I think, 5 drinks per hour for you guys, you know. Phew, man, you know. However, but last but not least, I do want to once again thank the sponsors that helped this event come together. Most importantly, Achilles. Without Andrew, the idea would not even have formed. Corel and Rebel to be co-hosting with HP, Lokia, Puffin Group, and of course, Eurocom. All of us have participated in a wonderful event, and I thank you for coming. Last but not least, I got a few draws that we get to do. So, Craig, you got some numbers for me? Andrew, why don't you pull the first one here? We need, we've got user-friendly hats. We got 5 of them.
Give me.
Oh, I should be able to get one easily enough anyway.
Knowledge, I'm sorry, fellas. Oh, it's written there, too. Okay, let's come up and get them. Rick Berger. Human Resources. Yeah, sure. Just keep pulling them. Ryan Tilder.
Oh. Yeah.
Now, of course, Ryan, of course, winning the hat means you're out of the running for the Netminders, you know, so I'm sorry. How about Christopher Blizzard? Dan Morrison. Oh, yes.
Woo!
Dan. Yay!
Good
How about CDs from Achilles?
Red Hat
6 CDs, actually.
Red Hat 6? Red Hat
6.
Doug Weimer, Unigraphics.
You'd rather have sushi?
No.
Here?
Well,
sushi.
Here?
Oh.
That's tomorrow morning. Okay.
Dim sum thing.
Richard Muse, Nortel.
Thanks, man.
Probably.
Here, Richard. Ian Hodge, Nortel. These are the starving developers that need free Red Hat. You know? Alan Drewsdale. Thanks, man. And last but not least, David Rosten, HyperConnect Interactive. How about Civilization, Call to Power? From Loki. Thank you, Loki. Dan Rogers, Island Internet.
Wrong?
Mark Lamoureux, St. Lawrence College.
Yay, Dan.
Yay, Dan.
Right on, man.
Wow.
Is that you coming up there, Mark? Thanks for coming, huh? Hugh.
The patch.
Hugh. Pardon me. Redemeyer? Redelmeyer.
Wow.
You left on the train.
No.
Yeah. But I can take the car.
Henry Spencer probably got to take it.
We'll give that to him.
Henry Spencer left on the same train.
Oh. Yeah. Julie Lavoie, Concordia University. One more?
It's the game where you get to nuke Mexico all the time.
Uh-huh. Thank you very much. Mike Redden, Carleton University.
Hey, Mike.
Well done, Mike. Thanks very much. Last but not least, it gives me great pleasure to have a draw for a Netwinder developer model and a Netwinder rack mount unit. And to do this, I would like to call the designer of the Netwinder, Pat Byrne from Corel, to make the draws, please. Pat. One way to keep inventory recycling, you know. Matt Salter.
Is Matt here? All right. This is the new paper version.
And last but not least, for the rack mount server from Human Resources Development Canada, Steve Tuzutaraki.